All right. So tonight we are going to be in 1 Kings chapter 2. And on Sunday, Jason went through chapter 1, which was a heck of a meal. And I think chapter 2 is a bit filling as well. But it's it leads right into it. It's a really great continuation. We are going to see finally now. I don't want to say finally. We are going to see the end of David. That is it. David's life is coming to an end. And so I don't know. I'm gonna leave this up to Randall, because I'll always get a question. Hey, what title should we give this on whatever? So Randall, you got two title options. Oh, excellent. I was gonna go with the king is dead, long live the king. Because whenever I saw that in the movies, I'd just be like, well, that seems odd. But, you know, it's kind of what was said, and I see it. I see Solomon in the continuation of the ministry of David. In some cases, even doing it a little bit better than his dad. His dad had tied his hands a couple of times, and Solomon gets to wrap up some loose ends. To see a young man as decisive as Solomon is pretty rare. You know, usually if you get a young man that's decisive, they're usually very full of themselves and they're, you know, a bit cocky and whatnot. But I don't really see that in Solomon. And so I think we'll just really get into the word, and we will kind of uncover a bit of this. Oh, my other option, although I've been told I don't have a choice anymore, my other option was Solomon the Just. But that kind of gives away the surprise ending. Sorry. All right. So chapter 2, verse 1, when the time drew near for David to die, he gave a charge to Solomon, his son. I'm about to go the way of all the earth, he said. So be strong and act like a man. And I thought, man, for our society that we currently live in, if somebody were to say, act like a man, and I'm not even talking about within the last 10 years, just seems like within the last 5 years, if somebody says, hey, you know, man up, buttercup, act like a man, it seems like that triggers so many people. And act like a man doesn't mean that there's something wrong with femininity, but it does mean that there is something right with masculinity. And I feel like in our generation has done an awful job. And I'm going to say our generation as the church has done an awful job of letting masculinity be destroyed. And I can't. And it's almost like the unspoken secret. Like, masculinity is a good thing. And I would be willing to bet that even the ladies in here would be like, yes, I want my husband to act like a man. Now, that doesn't mean that we get into the toxic masculinity and we get into justification of abuse by all means. Absolutely not. But I do believe there is still women out there who seek a man to act like a man. And David's final words to his son is, act like a man, be a man. And yes, I admit, we smell, we're crude. Sometimes our language isn't as great as it needs to be. Sometimes our temper isn't what it needs to be. But when you define a man only by the negatives, you throw the baby out with the bathwater. And it seems like we've gotten to be a society that defines femininity only by its positives and masculinity only by its negatives. And that isn't what God's design was at all. You know, God's design was for us to be in partnership with one another. You know, there are positives and negatives to both genders. And we work that out, you know, in our relationships and in our marriages or however it may be. It gets worked out. And so I do really like the fact that David his final breaths to his son is, act like a man, be a man. And we're going to get into, as we see, I think David's family, and I think some of what he was seeing in chapter 1, was that he is choosing Solomon because Solomon has more potential to act like a man than some of his other sons. So I think in this case, it's a good thing. So picking up, this is the other thing. This is like just, boy, I hope my last words are as powerful as this. So be strong, act like a man, and observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in obedience to him and keep his decrees and commands and his laws and regulations as written in the law of Moses. Do this so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go, and that the Lord may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me with all of their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a successor on the throne of Israel. Act like a man, and character counts. His last two words to his son, act like a man, and character counts. And maybe, as Jason was musing a little bit last week, and I could muse a little bit in the, or not last week, but Sunday, I could muse a little bit, maybe he's looking on over his life and looking on over maybe regrets and successes in his life. And he's maybe summed that up into his last words, his commands to the new king, his son, act like a man and your character counts. And God's promise is real. God's promise is real, but there's something that we have to do to it, right? Going on in verse 5. Now you yourself know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me. So, act like a man, character counts. Let me give you some deets. I got the 411, and I know I'm old because I say I got the 411. But here we go. We got the 411. I'm giving you the details. I'm going to give you a little, like, you know how in National Treasure there's the secret presidential book in that? So this is, you know, there's only been two kings, so the secret king book is not that big. So David's kind of giving him the lowdown on, in some cases, some of his regrets. He goes, now you to yourself know what Joab the son of Zeruiah did to me, what he did to the two commanders of Israel's armies, Abner, son of Ner, and Amasa, son of Jether. He killed them, shedding their blood in peacetime as if it was in battle. And with that blood, he stained the belt around his waist. Now, is David innocent of that? No, he did it as well. However, remember that David repented of that. David went through a long period of repentance. And so maybe we could say, okay, well, David, who are you to talk? Because you've had a great soldier killed when he didn't need to be. But David has gone past that. And I think there's wisdom in that. There is not only the fact that he committed his sin, he felt guilty for his sin, but he also repented of his sin and moved on. And sometimes I feel like if we have truly repented, and sometimes we claim to have repented, but it still haunts us and it still drags us down. I think David is able to say this about him without necessarily a guilty conscience, justly saying it about him, because David has moved on in wisdom, in time, in repentance. He's moved on. That the blood stained the belt around his waist and that the sandals on his feet. Deal with him according to your wisdom, but do not let his gray hair go down on a grave in peace. It's a very flowery way to send out a death sentence. But show kindness to the sons of Barzillai and Gilead, and let them be among those who eat at your table. They stood by me when I fled from your brother Absalom. Remember, you have with you Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Beruim, who called down bitter curses on me the day I went to Manaim. When he came down to meet me at the Jordan, I swore to him, by the Lord, I will not put you to death by the sword. But now do not consider him innocent. So David is expressing regret for what he has promised. He knows that this is not a good man. He knows that he will be a poison to the kingdom. And yet he is bound by his word because he has given his word that he would not be put to death by David's hand. So what does David do? He gives instructions to the new king. I wouldn't touch him. Doesn't mean you can't. All right. You are a man of wisdom and you will know what to do to him. Bring his gray head down on the grave in blood. Then David rested with his ancestors and was buried in the city of David. He had reigned for 40 years over Israel, 7 years in Hebron, and 33 in Jerusalem. So Solomon sat on the throne of his father David, and his rule was firmly established. So to his dying breath, David has a desire for justice. And I think that says a lot about David, because I feel like when I was young, I had a very clear sense of justice. And I was going to right all the wrongs in the world, and I was going to change the world. But I think as we get older, that starts to fall away a bit. We start to say, you know what? There's things in this world I just can't change. There's things that I'm not going to be able to do anything about. And yet David, on his deathbed, still keeps that fervor and desire for justice. Right? He's given these last directions, basically his dying wishes. And remember that in all of this, David always had in his mind the protection of Israel. Right? Even when David was at his worst, remember, he would be like, you know what? I'm going to go away from Jerusalem because I don't want the battle to damage the city of Jerusalem. I don't want innocent lives lost. I don't want people's homes destroyed. I don't want any of that. So David's great desire, even though we know that he wasn't an awesome dad and definitely wouldn't be the example of a husband that we need to be looking up to, but as a king, his great desire for his people, his protection was always there. And so we see in his final words to Solomon that continued protection for Israel, protecting the people. He knows that there are some sneaky Petes that are within the ranks. He's letting his son know, don't worry, I'm not fooled by these people. I know exactly what they have in their minds. I know exactly what they have in their heads. And you need a swift and surgical strike. These are the people that need to be gone. All right? So, could you imagine if here you are, a young guy, not even the eldest of the brothers. You are touted as wise beyond your years. Your father, the king, is leaving the kingdom to you. And the first thing he delivers to you is a hit list. Now, this is a young man who has not been a soldier, who's lived a very comfortable life, and now this is what he is delivered to him as his charge as king. And I think if I were Solomon, I would feel a little uneasy, to say the least. I would feel inadequate. And I feel like whenever I've taken on a new challenge in my life, if I've taken on a new job, if I've taken on a new place to live or something like that, I've always felt a bit inadequate. Didn't mean that I didn't move forward. And I think that maybe Solomon might be feeling a bit inadequate. I'm not sure. But man, does he kind of man up through this chapter. So now it says that his kingdom is firmly established with the passing of his father. He is the king. There was a little hiccup in the first chapter about who should be king, who shouldn't be king. But it is clear now before all of Israel, the king is Solomon. Solomon's throne is established. Verse 13. Now, Adonijah, the son of Haggith, went to Bathsheba, Solomon's mother. Bathsheba asked him, "Do you come peacefully?" He answered, "Yes, peacefully." Then he added, "I have something to say to you." "You may say it," she replied. "As you know," he said, "the kingdom was mine." All right, let's. Right now, when that if I were Bathsheba, right now I'd be like, okay, let's see where this goes. "As you know," he said, "the kingdom was mine. All Israel looked at me as their king, but things changed, and the kingdom has gone to my brother." Notice he didn't say your son. He said my brother. "For it has come to him from the Lord, and now I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me." Oh, you know, when somebody comes up to you and says, "I need to have some news for you, promise you won't get mad." You know you're going to get mad, right? Right? If somebody comes up to you and says, "Hey, I have a big favor to ask, and promise me you'll just say yes," how often are you like, "Oh, yeah, go for it. Yeah, sight unseen, you bet, you got it. My word, no problem." Right? And we know in chapter 1, this guy was trying to be yet another overtaker of the kingdom. Here he is bragging up, "Okay, it's the Lord's will. Yes, Solomon. Yes, Solomon's the king. Lord's will. I get all that. Yes. All right. I'm fine. I'm humbled. I've learned my lesson. But you know what? Just one favor. You know, my brother, the king, not your son." Right? Because notice that he's introduced as the son of his mother. Right? So I think that there's something there. I think with all of the children of David, there's something to be said about the influence of each of their mothers. Because you can see definite personality types carrying through full siblings. And I see that definitely here. "Now I have one request to make of you. Do not refuse me." "You may make it," she said. So he continued, "Please ask King Solomon," not my brother anymore, "please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag, the Shuhamite, as my wife." And Bathsheba says, "Very well." And I don't know. Man, I have a lot of speculation on her answer to that. A lot of speculation. Because you know that this is the girl that was the bed warmer, right? Just, you know, cute little thing, laying in bed with her husband, no problem. And I would imagine if I were Bathsheba and my spouse had others, I'd be more than happy to marry them off to somebody else, right? And so I could see Bathsheba wanting to get rid of this thorn in her side. And so she says, "Very well." Bathsheba replied, "I will speak to the king for you." When Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak for Adonijah, the king stood up to meet her. What a good son. Stands up to meet her, bows down to her, sits down on his throne. He had a throne brought into the throne room for the king's mother, and she sat down at his right hand, at the seat of power, right? "I have one small request to make to you," she said. do not refuse me. Wow, there seems to be an echo in that room, right? The king replied, make it, my mother, I will not refuse you. This is very interesting to me. Because Solomon shows himself, he's using his words, he's saying, yes, you know what, I'm going to make that, you're my mom, I respect you, you're in a seat of power, you're a source of wisdom to me, of course I wouldn't refuse you. And what good son, what good adult son with the means would ever refuse their mom, right? Who would do that? Your mom comes and says, I have a small favor, and you're like, yeah, mom, whatever, no problem, whatever you want, just ask it. So the king replied, make it, my mother, and I will not refuse you. So she said, let Abishag, the Shunammite, be given in marriage to your brother Adonijah. King Solomon answered his mother, why do you request Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? You might as well request the kingdom for him. After all, he is my older brother. Yes, for him and for Abiathar the priest and Joab the Zeruiah. Then King Solomon swore by the Lord, may the God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if Adonijah does not pay with his life for this request. Notice that even though he blindly promised for his mother, when she made the request, he easily changed his mind. Right? Because right is right and wrong is wrong. And this is definitely a wrong thing to be asking. Basically, his mom is coming in and saying, your brother, the older son, the one that traditionally should inherit the kingdom, is asking to marry one of your father's concubines. So can you do that? And he's like, so you want me to give one of dad's women to my brother? Do you not see that this is a power play? This is, he's trying to take the kingdom from me. And so I'm thinking, for a young guy to show such wisdom and understanding, because I could imagine myself as a young guy, I would have been very easily manipulated in this time. Okay, this is what my mom is asking. I trust my mom. No problem. Okay, good. Gets him off my back. I've given him a favor. Now he'll be off my back. But he understands that politically speaking, this is going to be political suicide for him. He's giving one of his father's women to his brother. And not just one of his father's women, one of his father's prize women that was with him at the very end. Right? And now, as surely as the Lord lives, he who has established me securely on the throne of my father David and founded a dynasty for me, he promised Adonijah shall be put to death today. Swift decision. And you know what? When I read this for the first time, because I know what comes down the line, I know what Solomon is famous for doing, I know the reason that Solomon is chosen to build the temple, and I remember, you know, kind of coming up through my Christian study, that Solomon gets to build the temple because he is a man without blood on his hands. So what does that mean? There's obviously blood on his hands, right? It's a question of innocent blood versus justice. So Solomon is showing himself to be an extremely just person right now. So King Solomon gave orders to Benaniah, son of Jehoiada, and he struck down Adonijah, and he died. To Abiathar, the priest, the king said, go back to your fields in Anathoth. You deserve to die, but I will not put you to death now because you carried the ark of the sovereign Lord before my father David and shared all my father's hardships. So in an act of swift justice, it is immediately followed by mercy. And I wish I had that kind of restraint, because I know that when I feel like I'm angry and justified in my anger, I feel like I will just lay waste, right? And yet Solomon, showing wisdom, not only does he swiftly act, carry out a death sentence on his own brother, now he turns to someone that he knows is not necessarily somebody that should be alive, but he shows mercy to him. He says, you know what? You were chosen to carry the Ark of the Covenant. You're with my dad in all of his hardships. For that, your life is spared. Right? So Solomon removed Abiathar from the priesthood of the Lord, fulfilling the word that the Lord had spoken at Shiloh about the house of Eli. So Solomon did not necessarily look into scriptures and say, how can I fulfill a prophecy today? He made a move that was politically sound, and he made a move that did definitely express that this person was going to be put out. This person was no longer going to have his position in the royal priesthood, but his life is spared. Little did Solomon know that this would be a fulfillment of prophecy. And I think that a lot of times when we hear about prophecies that are fulfilled, that we think, oh, well, you know, this person is reading scripture and they're trying to present themselves as this mighty king or this mighty warrior. They're trying to present themselves as a fulfiller prophecy. But I think what really happens, and I think that, we can experience this as well as sometimes when we have made the right decision or when we have been in tune with what God has wanted for us, we don't necessarily know it until after the fact. And then we start to see the path that God has led. We have seen the stepping stones, and we're like, oh, you know what? Now I can be confident. I can be comfortable in this decision that was made because it's obviously from God, right? And sometimes we don't see that until we've stepped over, right? And I heard somebody say one time that the Red Sea never split until Moses put his foot in the water, right? The Red Sea didn't part until Moses put his foot in the water. And sometimes when we're going through the heat of it and we're going through the mess of it, we don't necessarily see exactly what's going on. But when we act justly, and we do rightly, and we're seeking the Lord's face and we're seeking his wisdom, that it will be revealed sometimes after the decision that that was the right decision to make. And I think that's what's happening here in the fulfillment of prophecy. When the news reached Joab, who conspired with Adonijah, though not with Absalom, he fled to the tent of the Lord and took hold of the horns at the altar. This should sound familiar. King Solomon was told that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord and was beside the altar. Then Solomon ordered Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, go strike him down. Wait a minute. Didn't we learn on Sunday that you didn't strike down somebody who's touching the horns of the altar? Wasn't that there on Sunday? That's the Ollie Ollie Oxenfree. That's the home base. That's the hide and seek. Here I am. You can't get me. Na 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 boo boo. It doesn't matter, right? Isn't that what we learned? Well, what we learned is that's the cultural belief, but it wasn't necessarily biblically stated. You see, that's what people had put on to the altar, but that's not what God had defined the altar as, right? And sometimes we think that there are things that we are doing because they are godly, because the church does them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what God has said. Because what we have to understand and what we have to agree is we are part of a culture, whether we like it or not. We are Americans. And there are things that the American church struggles with that the church in other countries do not struggle with. And I'm not going to get into it because I'm not going to really use this time to anger people. But there are certain things that we do that may not necessarily be biblical, but be American. Okay? There's certain values that we have as Americans. And I'm not touting that, and I'm not definitely not anti-American by any stretch of the imagination. But when I had experienced churches in another country, it was very unique to me that their view of me as an American Christian is that I was the better Christian. And meanwhile, just as an example, I saw people who did not struggle with greed. I saw people who didn't know where their next meal was coming from, but would throw their final equivalent of a dime into the offering plate. And I don't see Americans doing that, right? So the altar, culturally speaking, was a place where you went, you grabbed the horns, ollie ollie oxen free, I'm on home base, you can't touch me. But you know what Solomon said is, you know what? That's not from God, that's from our society. And so Solomon divided what the society had interpreted as God's law from the actuality of God's law. And so Solomon says, go strike him down. So Benaniah entered the tent of the Lord, said to Joab, the king says, come out. But he answered, no, I will die here. Benaniah reported to the king, this is how Joab answered me. Then the king commanded Benaniah, all right, do as he says. Strike him down and bury him. And so clear me, my whole family, of the guilt of the innocent blood that Joab shed. The Lord will repay him for the blood that he shed, because without my father David knowing it, he attacked two men and killed them with the sword, both of them, Abner, son of Ner, and commander of Israel's army, and Amasa, son of Jether, commander of Judah's army. Were better men and more upright than he? May the guilt of their blood rest on the head of Joab as he descends forever. But David and his descendants, his house, his throne, may there be the Lord's peace forever. So Benaniah, son of Jehoiada, thank you, went up and struck down Joab and killed him, and he was buried at his home out in the country. The king then put Benaniah, son of Jehoiada, over the army of Joab's position and replaced Abiathar with Zadok the priest. Then the king sent Shimei, and said to him, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there, but do not go anywhere else. The day you leave and cross the Kidron Valley, you can be sure you will die. Your blood will be on your own head. Shimei answered the king, what you say is good. Your servant will do as the Lord the king has said. And Shimei stayed in Jerusalem for a long time. But 3 years later, two of Shimei's slaves ran off to Achish, son of Maacah, king of Gath. And Shimei was told, your slaves are in Gath. At this, he saddled his donkey and went to Achish at Gath in search of his slaves. So Shimei went away and brought the slaves back from Gath. When Solomon was told that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath, he had returned. The king summoned Shimei and said to him, did I not make you swear by the Lord and warn you on the day that you leave to go anywhere else, you can be sure you will die? And at that time you said to me, what you say is good, I will obey. It feels like Solomon keeps meticulous legal records, doesn't it? Like, didn't we say this, and wasn't this your response? It's almost like a court reporter is reading it back for him, right? He's like, "Ah, listen, I was there. I know what you said. I know what we'd agreed on. Why then did you not keep your oath to the Lord and obey the command I gave you?" The king also said to Shimei, "You know in your heart all the wrong that you did to my father, David. Now the Lord will repay you for your wrongdoing, but King Solomon will be blessed, and David's throne will remain secure before the Lord forever." Then the king gave the order. Now the Lord will repay you for your wrongdoing, but King Solomon will be blessed, and David's throne will remain secure before the Lord forever. Then the king gave the order to Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, and went out and struck Shimei down, and then he died. The kingdom was now established in Solomon's hands. So, there's a lot there. And where there is areas of neglect, there is not just incidental neglect. There was like legally binding neglect, like the kinds of things that these major lawsuits with the lawyers on TV are like suing people for. Did you use this product and now you have cancer, and these people knew that this was a cancer-causing product, right? So where Shimei had been neglectful, it wasn't just a, "Oops, I made a mistake." It was treasonous. It was known neglect. And so Solomon gave mercy, gave an opportunity for him to just be exiled. It's not that that's not a punishment, right? I would see it the same as people who argue whether life in prison or the death penalty is an appropriate kind of thing right now, or appropriate sentence for murderers. But Shimei was exiled. He had been stripped of the priesthood. He was no good. He had no honor amongst his home any longer. And Solomon had done that in a just and merciful manner. Yet, it's almost like they knew this guy couldn't stay out. As he said very clearly, "You come back, you will be no more." And so Solomon, with the final, with those words of his father ringing in his ear, "Be a man," means be a man of your word as well. He carried out his word. And it was exactly what his father knew had to be done. His father told him, "This is going to have to be done. The guy is no good. He's a snake. Take care of him. Cut the head off." And it's what eventually was done. Chapter 2 ends with stating that the kingdom of Solomon is established. And so as I have gone through this, and I know we've done a lot of very text-heavy reading, I started thinking about, well, when we think of people who have had leadership, we start to define what defined their leadership. That could be your boss. It could be a president, or it could be a political leader, right? We can look back on certain presidents and said, this person was president during this time, and this is what defined their leadership, right? Defined their rule, defined their reign. And Solomon, in the span of one chapter here, in the span of a very short time, I started to list some of the things that I felt were definers of his rule. First thing I put is that he cleansed the last remnant of Saul. One of the thorns in David's side was Shimei, right? He had formerly worked with Saul. So the last of the last of the last of the last kingdom of Saul that survived through David's reign, because David gave his word not to kill him, was now gone. So the last line of Saul, the last political incumbent under Saul, is gone. So now the house of David is moving on, right? You know, when we talk about the kings of Israel and David being the greatest king of Israel, and people seem to forget about Saul. Well, people forget about Saul because Saul's line was cleaned out. It was surgically removed. It's done, right? The other thing that Solomon reigns with mercy, he defines his reigning as a merciful reigning. He gives people an opportunity to do right. If they choose not to do right, then it's a reign of justice. So both mercy and justice, and many times his father refers to him as wise. So wisdom, mercy, and justice, which I think if we were to ask for a leader, would be the three things that we would ask for, right? Solomon has a reign of vision, right? He has vision, he's decisive, he makes a decision, he makes it, and it's not necessarily emotional, but he uses wisdom to make that decisive vision statement. And whereas his brother was manipulative, going through the mother to get what he wanted, Solomon doesn't do that. He's straightforward. He lays his cards out on the table, he calls it what it is, and he goes forward. So there's no double talk. There's no backroom deals. There's no pork in the bills that are coming before Congress. He says, here's what it is. White is white. Black is black. We're going to take care of this. And this is all amazing things that we wish our leaders would be like, right? Don't we wish that we had politicians like this? And our politicians all feel like if they were like this, there's no way they would get reelected, right? But you know what? When you have a king, he doesn't worry about being reelected. So he is decisive. He is clear. He is exactly what we look for in a leader. And I think if we go back to what his father had said, right? Follow the Lord's will. Do what he says. His word is really important. And above all else, act like a man. And I think that's exactly what Solomon's reign is doing here. He is defining himself not only as a man, but a man of God. His decisions are godly, they are right, they are just, and they are merciful. And I think they are a wonderful type to define the Christ that would come later. Jesus walked this earth decisively, with mercy, and loving justice. And I think Solomon is a great picture of that as well. That is where I am ending because I'm over my time already. Jason, did you want to pray? All right.